man. Vice President-to-be, Bob Dole, Mrs. Dole, other distinguished guests here at the head table, and you ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I was just telling the senator outside how tough it was to get here beginning yesterday. We started from Los Angeles, due for Concord, New Hampshire, and it was almost as tough getting there by way of Boston as it was to get to Washington by way of Kansas City. A two-hour delay in a jumbo jet on the West Coast because of a little gadget that I didn't know what it was, but it didn't work. And then the plane that was to meet us there didn't arrive, and by that time we got on the third plane to come from there last night late down here, I was beginning to think that maybe someone was trying to tell us something. But it is a pleasure to be here. I know that you're the workers and you're the ones in our party that do the job that has to be done. Let me just say a word before the very pleasant chore then that has been assigned to me. I think our party has a greater opportunity this time than we've had in a long, long time, if you and I will analyze what it is that we have, but it's like anyone else who's got something to sell. We have a hard selling job because of an image that's been laid on us over the years. We have an opportunity, I think, to counter that image better than we've had in the past. Jimmy Carter isn't riding quite as high in the straddle as he was. Possibly some of the blisters broke. He's just learning right now that it's pretty hard to apologize or get out of something that you had no business saying in the first place. Sometimes when you hear him answer a question, it reminds you of the family that the mother and father went to a wedding, and the little four-year-old boy said to his sister, "What's a wedding?" And she says, "You're too young to understand, but it's something that's between dancing school and a funeral." But you know, when I say we have an opportunity, political parties down through the years have kind of sometimes fuzzed up what it is they represent, hoping that they won't embarrass any of the candidates. Usually the hierarchy of the party hands down, as the Democratic Convention they did, a platform and says, "Oh, this is what we believe." And the Democratic platform this year says what they believe is continuing what they've been doing for the last 40 years. And that is more spending, more inflation, more unemployment, more of the problems that are wrong. You and I must know by now that after 40 years, the social tinkering that they've undergone all those years has proven to be a costly and expensive failure. But in their platform, they promise some 60 additional new programs. On the other hand, the Republican Party, this time from the grassroots level, adopted a statement of principles that I would call a bold banner of bold colors that states explicitly what it is we represent. I would just give you one thing because it's not my point to make a speech here. But let me just turn to the international scene, and if I can tell you one thing that chills me down my spine when I read it in the Democratic platform. I recall, as many of you do, that it was the Secretary of State of the United States some years ago who was listing publicly the names of the nations in the Pacific area in Asia that were essential to our national security. And whether inadvertently or by intention, he omitted the name of South Korea. And omitting that name was taken as a cue of where we were or were not concerned. And in a matter of days, the North Koreans swept down across the border. And before it was over, 33,000 young Americans had given their lives. You look at the Democratic platform today, and there is the cue again that they would redeploy our forces in South Korea. In other words, withdraw our forces, our weaponry, our support in that particular area. The Republican platform says that we will maintain those forces there until we are absolutely sure that there is no danger of continued aggression from North Korea. That is the way you maintain peace. And that's the object of all that we're doing in the world scene. not trying to position ourselves to win a war, but position ourselves to maintain peace. The Democratic platform further says that they believe in an adequate defense, but they'll cut the budget by $5 to $7 billion for defense. That's a little bit like the young fellow that called his girl on the phone and said, I love you so much, I'd climb the highest mountain to be by your side, I'd swim the deepest river, I'll be over Wednesday night if it doesn't rain. Ours tells the American people, there's one way to preserve the peace, and that is to restore superiority of arms in the United States. But it could go on, and there's someone else here better able and is going to tell you about this. It's my pleasure now to introduce a man who served his country and his party. He served his country in what I've just been talking about, in a time of war, and served it heroically. He then came back, and he has served in public life. He's now a United States Senator. Before that, he was the national chairman of our party, and now he is our candidate for vice president, and I am more than proud to be here and be able to present to you the next vice president of the United States, Senator Bob Dole.
I hope those of you who went to Yale will forgive me. My wife's from Harvard, but otherwise, right? I thought I'd better confess to that. Well, I'm very pleased to be here. Of course, very honored and privileged. I guess someone like Jimmy Carter said after the first debate, I'm somewhat awed to be on the same platform with Governor Reagan, because he's been a long time friend and a great Republican and sort of a hero of mine, and so I'm deeply pleased to be here. Does anybody doubt that there's unity in the Republican Party? It's there. And I think perhaps as we march on to victory on November 2nd, you're going to see Republicans and independents and Democrats coming together for a purpose. As the governor has indicated, we're concerned about leadership. We're concerned about peace and strength and freedom. And I say to my many, as I said last night, to my many Italian-American friends here, I left a little of my blood in Italy in 1945, and I want to get it back from you all on November 2nd, 1976. Since that happened, I've been to Italy a number of times and developed great friendships there. And I would just take this moment for a commercial, not mine, but I understand tomorrow there's going to be a door-to-door canvas. I hope everyone here is participating in that door-to-door canvas, because it's for the benefit of the Italian earthquake relief drive, to benefit the victims of that terrible earthquake. And so I trust if you're not a part of that, at least you're able to write. And you know what I mean, checks, of course, and anything else. But it indicates, and it's a bipartisan event, it's a bipartisan affair, but it underscores and emphasizes, has been true throughout history, the concern Americans have for those in need and those in trouble. So I salute you, our active participants. I want to touch on one other thing that Governor Reagan said, and that's the defense of our country. I read last night after the meeting, do you have a lieutenant governor named Killian?
Killian.
Who?
Killian.
Yeah, well, I knew he had to be somewhere. Democrat, and that's why I didn't know his name, but he... But he apparently knew my name, because he said I shouldn't come to Connecticut. because of all the base closings and cuts in defense, and he named several other things, and I wish I'd had an opportunity to read that glowing report before our meeting last night. But I would just say to that lieutenant governor and to others who follow the leadership, if you can call it that, of Governor Carter, when we talk about defense, we're talking seriously about freedom and liberty. And if you look what's happened over the past decade and see cut after cut after cut in our defense budget by the liberal Democrats in the Congress, at the same time in 1972, Governor Carter is saying it would be a tragedy to cut the defense budget. And then in 1975, he says we ought to cut it $15 billion. And then in 1976, he said we ought to cut it $5 to $7 billion. At the same time, our Secretary of Defense is saying we may need to add to $18 to $20 billion. I get a little shaky. I kind of wonder what Mr. Carter has in mind. I don't want to be number one in the world for the sake of anything but peace. And that's what it's all about. And people in this room understand the value of freedom and the value of liberty probably as much or as more as any other audience in America. And so I say to your lieutenant governor, if you're concerned about the defense in our country, if you're concerned about the strength of America, you better direct your remarks to Governor Carter and not to Senator Dole. I've often repeated the story, and since it's been alluded to, people ask how we got into what we're doing. And I remember when I first went to Congress, they used to send me out to speak a lot in very safe districts, either safe Republican or safe Democrat, where I couldn't cause any problems. And I remember going to Indiana one time, very safe Republican district. They were having a big fundraising event. I arrived Saturday afternoon. The dinner was Saturday evening. When I got off the plane, the county chairman was almost in a state of collapse because he said the advance ticket sale had already reached 10. 10, that is. 10. I was Congressman Bob Dole from Western Kansas. He didn't know whether it was Dole or Doyle or whatever. He didn't really care, but he had a disaster on his hands, and I was part of it. So they rushed me out to the local radio station to try to drum up some support. And they went all through my biography, which didn't take but a minute. I was born and raised, and that's about where it ended. And they went through the horrible war story and all that, and as we left the station to go back to the town in Indiana, the announcer was saying that Congressman Bob Dole will speak tonight. He was born in Kansas, raised in Kansas. He's now in Congress. Prior to World War II, he was a pre-medical student. He suffered a serious head injury in the war and then went into politics. So I don't... So I don't know how you got here, but I know how I got here. And I want to say one thing, that pineapple juice is a lot better for you than peanut butter. For one thing, it doesn't stick to the roof of your mouth. So... Well, I won't take much more of your time, but I want to reemphasize a point that I made last night. Governor Carter has given a lot of interviews. Some you may have read, some you may be anticipating. He talks on a variety of subjects. I've always thought a picture is worth 10,000 words, but I haven't seen the pictures yet, so I can't really say that. But there's another little statement coming out, and in fact it is out, in the September-October 76 issue of Liberty. This is the Seventh-day Adventist publication. Mr. Carter was asked how he felt about taxation of church property, and he replied, and I quote, these are his words, not mine. I quote, "I would favor the taxation of church properties other than the church building itself." End of quote. Now, I find it incredible that Mr. Carter wants to impose taxes on church-owned hospitals, schools, senior citizens' homes, and orphanages. Is that really what he favors? Or just another case where Governor Carter has said something, as the governor said, and may have to apologize later? And I ask you to think about the implications of that statement. Now, you'll probably say, well, it'll be up to Congress anyway. He probably couldn't do anything. And it makes the point I've been trying to make in the 35 or 36 days that I've been privileged to be on the ticket with President Ford. To talk about the Republican Party, yes, and the Republican Party platform, as Governor Reagan says, it was not a Reagan platform, it was not a Ford platform, it was a delegate's platform. It's an outstanding platform, and we're running on that platform. And if you haven't seen the 30-minute special with Governor Reagan, you don't know what you've missed. And I would say if you have Democrat friends or independent friends, when that program is shown on a regional basis, have them take a look at it. We're talking about America. We're talking about the direction we're going to go. We're talking about leadership. And where do you go to find the answer? You go to the platform. And I don't suggest that President Ford would have written it just that way, Governor Reagan would have written it just that way, or anyone would have written it just the way it is. But ours is the work and the result and the effort of delegates to that convention. Theirs is the work and the result of the Carter staff at the New York City Convention. And that's the difference. That's the basic difference. And there are some 65 new or add-ons or increased spending programs in the Democrat platform. There will be 22 new or expanded or increased agencies as a result of the new programs and added to spending programs in the Democrat platform. And this from the same man who says he wants to streamline the government, end inflation, balance the budget, and reduce unemployment at no cost to you. Fantastic. Fantastic. Where has he been all these years? And why doesn't he address his remarks to the Congress, to the liberals and the Democratic Congress who controlled the Congress for some 22 years? 22 years straight and 40 out of the last 44 years. I think we all also know there's great influence in that platform by labor leaders, not the rank and file working man and woman. And someone asked George Meany one time why he didn't run for president. He said, why step down? Why step down? And if Carter's elected, there are going to be two hotlines, one to Russia and one to George Meany. And that's just about the influence that one labor leader has on the Democratic Party. The working men and women in this country are concerned about our defense. They're concerned about government spending. They're concerned about taxes. And they're going to vote independently. And they're going to vote for the Ford Dole ticket. And let me conclude by saying this. When Governor Carter made his acceptance speech and said the national tax system is a disgrace, every American should have applauded that. What he didn't say, as I've said before, the Democrats have controlled this Congress. They're chairman of the committee in the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee. And tax measures originate in the House, according to the Constitution. So I just say to you, just take a hard look at the platforms. Take a hard look at the candidates. I think many of you like to take a hard look at his statement in the September-October 76 issue of Liberty Magazine. He's been saying a lot of things lately. I just believe that indicates a rather weird performance and weird judgment. And I don't know how many more interviews he has going to pop up in the next 30 days. But these are statements that he made, and these statements only affect him. I'm not so concerned about the statements that only affect him. I'm concerned about what might happen if he were elected and then made these judgments. He wants to be interviewed by Playboy, that's his judgment. That only affects him. But he's going to make decisions, if he should become the president, affect us and everyone in this room, and a lot of people not in this room, a lot of Carter supporters who ought to be taking a cold, hard look. What he does privately is his concern. How it affects him is his problem. But how it affects you and how it affects us and how it affects the American people, that's our problem. And so I say it's time we went to work. And we're going to carry the state of Connecticut. The polls show us 7 to 8 points ahead in the state of Connecticut. That's good news. And I've had the privilege and the honor and the opportunity to know President Ford for 16 years. And come November 2nd and come next January, you're going to find President Ford in the White House. You're going to find that same decent, honest, open, candid American giving you the leadership we all need. Thank you very much.
Senator Dole.
Hey, Vermont, we're very pleased to be here, and this is another area that we think we see a great deal of movement in, and we're confident that Bob Stafford's going to be reelected and President Ford's going to be elected.
Senator, you've been a frequent defender of Agriculture Secretary Watts. Has your view changed any as a result of this controversy over his remarks?
Well, I haven't read the remarks, but what little I know about them, I think it's another indication where the public getting a little sick and tired of people making stupid statements and issuing apologies, whether it's Butts or Carter.
Are you saying it was a stupid statement, Senator?
It was a very ill-conceived statement and tasteless, and I didn't suggest that. I just said that's my view of the matter. President Ford, I understand, has reprimanded the Secretary.
Do you think this shows the same kind of judgment problem as you've been discussing with Carter?
I think to some degree, except Butts is not running for president.
Should he resign, Senator?
That's a matter for the president to determine.
Senator, could you elaborate a little bit on your remarks earlier about taxing church property? What do you see as wrong with taxing church property other than the building?
I raised the question. That's Governor Carter's to explain. I'm not going around getting him off the hook in this campaign.
Could you give your views on it?
No, I'll just give you his views. He made the statement. I'm not the policymaker. He's running for president.
Do you think it's wrong to tax church property other than the building?
Anybody else have any questions?
I feel lonely on the campaign trail. When's President Ford going to get out and join you?
Oh, he's leaving Monday for a six-day swing, and he's going to be very active with the Congress. I guess we adjourned last night, didn't we, Bob?
Sometime during the night,
We left, in any event.
Senator,
you're going to see a lot more of the president out on the campaign trail.
How popular is Butts with the American farmers?
Well, it's really hard to gauge. You know, I've been around. We were North and South Dakota, Nebraska. It's difficult for any Secretary of Agriculture to be totally popular when prices are falling and prices are going down in farm states. Some have told me very strongly that, you know, you ought to get Butts out here. Butts ought to be out here more often. And others have said just the opposite. So,
do you think he's now liable in the farm states?
Do you think in the farm states?
Asset or liability?
Well, I think, again, as I just said, depends on where you are. Some places he's an asset, others probably not.
Do you think this remark that has been attributed to him is going to make him now a definite liability?
I don't know. I haven't had, you know, until I really read it and look at some of the reaction. I know that he was reprimanded very strongly by the president. I think that was a proper action. He's made a public apology. But as I said at the outset, I think it's easy to make statements. And I know he wasn't interviewed. This wasn't an interview. So, but whether it's Butts or Carter, it just seems to me the American people deserve better.
Senator, you remember
Thank you.
Senator, you remember the act.
To address these questions and others, we are pleased to welcome today Senator Robert Dole of Kansas, the Republican vice presidential candidate. Senator Dole served in the House of Representatives from 1961 to 1968. He was elected to the United States Senate in 1968 and re-elected in 1974. Richard Gallagher. Channel 3 in Burlington, and news reporter Jeannie Moose of WTTC Channel 5, Plattsburgh, New York. also joining us in the studio but not participating in the questioning are members of the National Press Corps who are covering the campaign of Senator Dole. Senator, welcome to the world.
Thank you very much.
In your travels across the country thus far, have you perceived this as a pocketbook campaign with jobs and the cost of living the major issues?
I mean, in some respects, we've traveled a great deal, I think 31 or 32 states so far, and I've done most of the traveling, and our ticket, I want to say first, I'm certainly happy to be here with Senator Bob Stafford this morning, and of course, other good colleagues, Bob Lady, so I think I'm in friendly territory, even though we may be in different counties, but... it's a great day in Vermont, and we believe it's a great day for President Ford. But with reference to the question itself, I would say yes. I think unemployment is an issue that hurts us very much. Governor Carter's been stressing that. Farm prices are somewhat of a problem. But overall, the economy is sound, and there have been gains made. There are 88 million people at work. Over 3 million have gone back to work or found a job in the past 17 months. So I think on balance, it's a plus for the Ford-Dole ticket, but it is an issue.
Mr. Gallagher?
Senator, the campaign in recent weeks at least has been disrupted, if that's the right word, to an examination of whether President Ford accepted hospitality at a country club and whether Mr. Carter did the same thing. In the aftermath of Watergate, is there a danger that we are going to pose impossible restrictions on public figures and demand that they cannot even accept the most modest kind of hospitality?
Well, I would hope not. I think we have an obligation to be candid and open. But I think we just take the golf and the hunting lodge, or one with Carter and one with Ford. If we ever reach a point in politics or in reporting the news or whatever we do for a living, we can't have friends, and you can't leave your friends out. How much was the dinner? Here's $10 for the dinner. I think it really imposes a sort of post-Watergate morality that was never really thought of. I think we have to watch ourselves. The point is there some exchange? Do I accept something on the basis that I will do something? That's wrong. If you can't have friends, they can either be some businessman or some labor leader or a farmer. I would hope we don't go too far.
Senator, many Democrats, especially in New York State, are worried about the candidacy of Senator Eugene McCarthy. And McCarthy said that he wouldn't lose any sleep if President Ford were to win as a result of his candidacy. Would you lose any sleep if you won? Is there a possibility of that happening?
I sleep a little better with McCarthy running. I've said to some of my friends, if you really want a true liberal, one that you can count on and know where he stands from day to day, take a look at Gene McCarthy. Now, he is going to have some impact on the Carter campaign in states like New York and other areas. He doesn't have, the forum to speak from. He doesn't attract thousands of people as Governor Carter does or President Ford. But I know Senator McCarthy. In fact, Sam, about 10 days ago, we just exchanged pleasantries, but he's had experience. He understands a great many of the areas. I don't think he has any hopes of winning, but he could have an impact on the election.
So you would be very grateful for any welcome you get from Senator McCarthy?
Well, I don't mean in the sense that I expect him to be out campaigning for President Ford, but he does add one more dimension. He does give a choice. And, of course, on the other hand, we have Lester Maddox, who I don't think offers any choice at all.
Senator Dole, as a member of the United States Senate, there seems to be have been over the course of the past couple of years a really adversary situation between the executive branch and the legislative branch with the 56 vetoes, 12 overrides. Do you think that some of these vetoes by President Ford have been calculated as political moves rather than a really philosophical move? And I refer to the latest one on HEW appropriation, which was overridden the next day by both houses.
Well, we just took that one, about $4 billion over the budget.
Yes.
I think once a president or a governor or whatever says publicly that I'm going to do what I can to hold down spending, and I'm going to veto this back and forth every bill that exceeds the budget or whatever, and that throws Toby Jeff for Casey for it. He must follow that line. There's some people say, well, he doesn't really have any principle. He signed this bill because it was a good politics. He vetoed the other because he thought it was good politics. I just think in Dorothy Ford's case, he's had the courage. The vetoes now are up to about 59, and 40-some have been sustained. Now, we can go into all the arguments how much money we've saved the American people, but it has had some impact on inflation. It points out something that I think is very important. Let's say we have Governor Carter in as president. He's criticized what we veto, which means he'd have signed every bill. And we added $9 to $10, $11 billion in spending, which would have heated the fire of inflation and really set us back. So I give President Ford high marks, but I agree with you. It poses a problem. And I think it's not a bad problem. The American people have sort of a check and a balance in the Congress and the White House.
But, Senator, to follow that up, the Senate has seemed to have really cleaned up its act in terms of the budget itself. Senator Muskie, the Budget Committee, and apparently the President does not agree that this budget, which was instituted by the Senate and by most accounts, seems to be doing the best job regarding the budget for several years.
Right, I'm on the budget.
I know you are.
I'll give everybody high marks, including Senator Muskie. It's a very tough job, but we're still in the preliminary stages of the budget. But I think we've done a remarkably good job, and I disagree with the administration from time to time on what the priority should be. I think finally the Congress is coming around the point that we're going to be willing to accept some of the responsibility. It's easy for me as a Republican to condemn a Democrat president. It's easy for a Democrat to condemn a Republican president. But now we have this mechanism, chaired by Senator Muskie, that's going to have some impact in this country. We're going to be responsible ourselves for some of the spending. I think it's had a good influence. I think it's a good sort of adversarial relationship we have with the Office of Managing the Government. Their budget, they're not always right, and we're not always right, but I think overall, President Ford is acting responsible, and so is the Budget Committee.
Senator, you've been around the country a great deal. In order to make any cuts, substantial cuts in government spending, there's no lot to be accepted by the American people with fewer programs. Are they ready to accept that?
Well, I think the American people are ready to accept cuts in programs if they understand what we're cutting and if it's done in a way that ensures that we don't do harm to a good program. Now, there's all the clamor in the Congress now. It comes from Democrats and Republicans, and I share that view. Senator Stafford shares that view. We ought to start looking at old programs. You know, we ought to have some exploration or some review of programs. We ought to really push the oversight function in the Congress. Whether it's defense or agriculture or education, if we had to go back and look at a program, an old one, instead of always thinking about a new one and spending more money, we could save some money at the same time improve the efficiency of the program, cut the administrative costs, cut down the error rate, and really provide more benefits to those who deserves a benefit.
In that same regard, President Ford has called repeatedly to get the government off the backs of business for American people. Yet when he tried to do that by proposing deregulation of the airlines and trucking industries, there were howls immediately from the airlines and trucking industries as a special interest. Does business really want to be free of government intervention, or is that so much political rhetoric?
Well, I think some of it is rhetoric. I think some of it, I think many people, if they're in, quote, special interest, whether it's labor, management, business, whatever, they see it one way. They talk about the regulations that affect someone else. But again, you know, I think President Ford is sincere in what he wants to do. And it's going to take a commitment by the Congress. I don't say that many members, Democrats and Republicans, don't have a commitment. But it's going to take a coming together and an agreement by both the legislative and executive branch that we're going to do this. And we can't just strip everything down at once and say, well, now you've deregulated the trucking industry, or we're going to deregulate airlines for far as we're concerned. But we've made some progress. I think we've made very little, frankly.
Senator, a leading activist organization,
the League of Conservation Voters, has rated Jimmy Carter as outstanding. They've called Ford hopeless. And based on Senate votes on environmental issues, Mondale was rated 78 out of 100. You got 38 out of 100. Could you comment on that?
Well, it appears I'm not quite hopeless if I got 38. I'd have to know what the issues were. We go around during our election and say, I've got a so-and-so rating or so-and-so rating. That's just someone's measure of our effectiveness. Now, most people can justify their votes where we have disagreements, but I think I'm concerned about the environment. I hope I am. I like to believe I am, but I assume that some would say I've made mistakes in judgment.
But on the trade-off between perhaps environmental protection and economic growth, which side would you come down on?
Well, the only good answer to that is neither. I'd try to balance the equities and come down where I felt that we were preserving the environment and still not stagnating growth. I mean, I think we have to have economic growth, but we can't have it at the expense of the environment. So somewhere along the line, we've got to assure and ensure that we're really sort of balancing the equities. It's a very difficult decision. And some people might rate you wrong if you voted a one way. The others might say you were balanced. But, there's some very clear distinctions. But on the whole, I don't know of anyone who just wants to strike out and destroy the landscape or pollute the water just because some big business or someone wants, quote, economic growth.
Senator Dole, you're the ranking Republican on the Senate Agriculture Committee. And you're in Vermont, which is a family farm state, a dairy state, essentially. And you have not supported the quarterly price supports nor the suggestions of some of your colleagues on the dairy price supports. Could you explain your stand to the Vermont farmers?
Well, I think I have one of the best farm records and ag records of, I don't want to be totally immodest in the Congress. I am on that committee. I am the ranking Republican. I am for quarterly adjustments insofar as dairy is concerned. I did oppose the increase to 85% of parity. I'm sort of reminded what Jimmy Carter said about that. He thought 80% was enough until he got up into a dairy state where he waffled as usual. But we work very closely with dairy leaders. I don't believe that my views are inconsistent with theirs. What we like is a strong market price, of course, and fewer imports, and we've always been on the right side on that one. But, there are the consumer interests involved. And every time you raise the price supports 5% in dairy, you add millions of dollars of cost to the American consumer. And they have a great interest in this legislation. And what most dairy farmers, and I represent a number in my state, would like would be a little less cheese and other stuff coming in and they'll take their chances on the marketplace, but they do need some supports, and I don't think my views are inconsistent with most of the farmers.
In terms of the consumer, again here, the consideration of the consumer, there apparently was no consideration of the consumer during the Republican administration that let sugar prices, for example, go to $1 a pound, and there still is a major problem over the Sugar Act.
Yeah,
how do you feel about that,
Senator? Because we have a Democrat Congress, we don't have a Sugar Act, The argument there is let's change the Congress around and get some new leadership. And of course, we've been out in the sugar areas where the sugar beet producers seen the price just cut in half in a year. And the result is the president has increased the tariffs, but that hasn't done much for the price. I think it's just like we were talking about earlier in trying to balance the environment and economic growth. We're going to have to balance the agricultural interest with a consumer interest. I just happen to believe that farmers have a right to make a profit. Now, some may say, well, when does that become unreasonable? Not being a bit defensive, I think my record's good in the farm area.
Senator, if we could consider that just a little bit more in specific terms. Here in Vermont, the price of milk retail is set by the state of Vermont. In neighboring New Hampshire, it isn't, so that you can drive your car across the Connecticut River and buy milk in New Hampshire substantially cheaper than you can in Vermont. So what you are doing by supporting the farmers at the state level here is penalizing the consumer. Is that a proper trade in your judgment?
Well, if that, is in fact the problem, the answer is probably no. But I think you have to weigh some other considerations into that. Vermont is not much different as far as agriculture as my state of Kansas. We see a decline in the farm population, fewer and fewer farmers, the so-called, and this is the home of the family farmer, But the family farmer can't farm if he can't make a profit. If you're going to have to go in business for your health, you open up a swimming pool or get into some other exotic area. But they have families to feed. They have taxes to pay. They have a right to make progress in their industry and to grow. So I don't buy the fact that I think as long as it's not undue subsidies from the government, whether it be price supports or whatever, then the consumers really have a right to complain because they're paying at both ends. They're paying at the marketplace and they're paying with their tax money.
We hear a great deal about the decline in farm population, which is, of course, a fact. But is that valid evidence that the farmer can no longer make it on the farm, or is it evidence that farmers are simply a great deal more productive than they used to be, and it takes fewer of them to produce the product?
Probably some of both. I've known farmers who left the farm. They didn't want to leave the farm, but they were able to find a better job and receive more income by moving away from the farm. They were faced with a choice of either expanding their production, expanding their acreage. They didn't have the capital to invest, but we also are, of course, more productive. We have better machinery and better equipment. Farmers really believe in productivity, and they've demonstrated it, which, and of course, the demand is not as elastic as it is in some areas either. The demand is fairly steady in some areas.
In your 1974 Senate race, abortion was a major issue, perhaps a deciding issue. You ran against Dr. William Roy, who was a Catholic, I believe, obstetrician.
He was a Protestant.
Protestant, obstetrician, okay. And you campaigned saying things like, at least I never performed one. Jimmy Carter is not a Protestant obstetrician, but abortion is, again, a major issue.
Right.
Could you elaborate on your position on abortion?
Right, I said at the time, and I want to... You know, it never was a major issue in our campaign. I never perceived it as a major issue in Kansas. It became an issue after the campaign, in the last couple of days of the campaign, when my opponent, after his defeat, said that was what defeated him. Well, I don't know what defeated him. I think it was a combination of a number of things, because he had a 12-point lead with a month to go. And I can't assess, we think, some of it, because we went out there and went to work and rallied our troops. It wasn't, we didn't win or lose the election. In my view, based on the abortion issue, I voted against federal funds for abortion. I've said I would support a constitutional amendment. I've not made abortion an issue in this campaign. I've never raised it. I don't think it's a proper political issue, and I don't think I raised it specifically in Kansas. But a lot of people are raising it for us. Don't misunderstand me. There's some on both sides who made it an issue, and that's their right. You know, people have rights in this country, but that's his assessment, not mine.
Senator Dole, there are many Americans who are really dismayed over our arms sales policies, particularly to Iran, to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia, and with the idea that if we build up one country, we have to then respond by reciprocating and continuing the arms escalation with Israel. What's the administration's stand, the Ford Dole stand, on the continuation of billions and billions of dollars of arms sales?
Now, what are those billions and billions of dollars? I want to be sure I understand the question.
Well, $10 billions of dollars that have taken place, apparently, since President Nixon originally instituted them, and then Secretary Kissinger has indicated recently that apparently we're going to have another $10 billion in arms sales to the Mideast, including some of our most sensitive electronic equipment.
Well, I just say in a very general way, because I don't know about these billions and billion dollars that you allude to, I think we have to have a policy. You know, Congress is going to review every sale. In fact, in the process now of reviewing sales, we also have to understand that we're going to have peace in the Mideast. We've got to bring the parties together. And there are some moderate Arab countries who are concerned about peace, and as well as the state of Israel. So I just don't think we close one eye and say, well, we'll do everything, we'll sell everything to Israel or however, and just turn our backs on the rest of the Middle East. I don't see any effort. If there was an effort to arm either side for war, then I would say, you know, it's ridiculous. We shouldn't do it in either case. But billions and billions of dollars,
Senator,
I don't know what you
Senator,
base it on.
The Humphrey report recently indicated that there are billions of dollars worth of weapons and arms and what have you piled up in Iran, American technicians there, and the possibility of American technicians to go to operate any of the material that we send to them. That it's so complex they cannot cannot operate it itself. And the suggestion has been made that there may be as many as 50,000 Americans who would have to go to teach the Middle Eastern people how to operate these things. But it is on record that we have sold billions of dollars of
weapons. I think it's also on record that that's a friendly state as far as we're concerned. You know, it's a little naive, and I know you work for Senator Leahy, so I don't want anybody to misunderstand that this is two Republicans visiting here, but I think it's a little naive to assume that we just suddenly don't worry about the Russian threat in the Mideast. We just sort of say, well, don't worry about that. They're not going to be any real threat in the Mideast. I think that's got to be focused on, and focused on very strongly. I haven't read the Humphrey Report. I don't discredit it. I just suggest that there are two sides to the question.
Well, and I want you to understand, Senator, that my employment with Senator Leahy has got nothing to do with a national issue such as arms sales. There are millions of Americans beside myself who are concerned about it.
Senator, well, I'm concerned about it, too. I just want to make that clear, but I've got to indicate just as strongly, and I think you agree, that there are two sides to the question.
Certainly, but what I was trying to establish was what the Ford-Dole policy is toward arms sales.
Senator, the administration is taking a much more emphatic position in Africa than we've ever taken before. The direction of it seems to be that we want to encourage more democratic rule, particularly in Rhodesia. But the fact is that Rhodesia is perhaps as democratic or more democratic than many of the black African states who are run by one party or even one man. What is going to be the administration's position toward black Africa? Are we going to exert the same kind of pressure toward democratic rule?
I don't know. I don't know whether Secretary Kissinger discussed that with President Ford, whether it is a presidential policy. But I think Secretary Kissinger is giving the right initiative and the right leadership in trying to resolve some of the problems that he's been engaged in. Just hope it hasn't fallen apart to the point where it can't be put back together. Something's going to happen. You're going to have majority rule. And I think Secretary Kissinger has taken a responsible lead at the direction of President Ford, even though it may be unpopular in some areas of this country. I think he should be commended for it, and it's another indication of his strength and his policy.
You say majority rule is inevitable, but are we talking about majority rule simply on the basis of race? A black government in Africa does not necessarily mean that it represents the majority viewpoint in that particular country. In Angola, for instance, the controlling factor right now represents about a third of the population.
Well, that was a case there where we had a Congress, and they've been noted for their increasing involvement in foreign affairs. I don't use the word interference. I think we have a right to become involved, but that was almost a case where the Congress dictated the policy in Angola. I can't respond to that. Even though I'm a part of the Congress, I didn't agree with what happened. I don't hope we don't run around in each country in this world trying to impose our views. But I think, again, where we have a problem, where we clearly see a problem, and where it becomes an international problem, we've got to focus some attention on it. And that's what Secretary Kissinger's done.
The latest Gallup poll shows that Carter's lead has been cut from about 18% to 8%. Would you attribute that increase in Ford support to Mr. Ford's campaign skills, your campaign skills, or to Mr. Carter's mistakes?
I think there may be a little error in that Gallup poll. I don't know whether it's reflected in this latest view. It may be 11 points instead of 8. I'm not certain how it's translated, but they did find a mistake in the first Gallup poll in Ford's favor, and if that carries on through. But in any event, there's movement away from Governor Carter to President Ford. Just seems to me that some is attributable, of course, to the fact that we're now one-on-one. Up until our convention in Kansas City, until August 19th, Carter had about a 4 or 5 week period there where there wasn't much happening at all. And Republicans were still fighting it out for who was going to be the nominee. So I think the lead then was arbitrarily high. Now it's one-on-one. Carter has made some mistakes. He's given interviews that some would question his judgment. I question his judgment, some of the interviews he's given. But that only affects him, as I said. What really worries me is the judgments he makes when it affects all Americans. So I think it's a combination. Plus, President Ford is perceived as a man of competence and confidence and projecting leadership, and he clearly won the first debate by all counts.
What about the vice presidential debate between you and Mr. Mondale? Will it be the same format as the Carter-Ford debate in terms of no direct exchanges between the candidates?
I don't know. In fact, I don't want to date the program, but there's, I think, a meeting in progress on our debate right now. trying to decide how long it will be, where it will be, the date it will be, and the format. Aside from that, we've worked out the other details. We're still some distance apart on the format. We'd like to liven up some.
Senator, we have just about 2 minutes of our program left. Yesterday, and again, we're dating this, but you mentioned that you called Governor Carter weird. What do you mean by that?
I said his performance is weird. Right. Well, it is sort of strange. You know, Jimmy, you run around here one day saying I'm going to raise the tax everybody above the median. The next day, Mondale said, well, he meant $50,000. Then he grants an interview with Playboy, which, again, is his right. Then he makes some reference to a distinguished former president, now deceased President Johnson, as a lying, cheating, distorting the facts. Then he rushes out to call his widow and says, well, I'm sorry, I apologize. You know, we really need a leader in this country. He says leadership for a change. Well, I think for a change, he ought to indicate he has the ability to lead this country. It's not enough to make excuses. He said, we're going to have these vicious personal attacks made upon me. He sets up the straw man. And I think his performance leaves a lot to be desired, and hopefully the voters will agree on November 2nd.
Less than a minute.
Senator, I understand that in the initial presidential debate, at the request of the candidates, the networks were barred from showing reactions in the audience. What was the reason for that?
I don't know. I wasn't in on the mechanics of that. I assume that there's always a theory that, and I don't even know this to be a fact, so it's strictly off the top of my head, that somebody could load the audience. And you would have a big demonstration for Ford or a big demonstration for Carter, and it would sort of remove the focus from the debate. Well, it really was a stand-up joint press conference about what it was, but it would remove that focus from the debate, and I would guess that was the reason.
I have to interrupt here because our time is gone. Senator Dole, we thank you a great deal for being with us today. Mr. Gallagher, Ms. Most, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for looking in. I'm Jack Barry.
Not in the loose form.
Well,
I've had sort of a report on it.
Have you seen the one of the sentences?
We're doing that.
I don't know.
We're doing a lateral interview here.
Oh, well, can you read that?
Yeah.
A track.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, totally tasteless. I just said, as I said out there, it's, you know, people, and I know that he might have thought he was having a private visit with John Dean, who was the other, Pat Boone, or
Sonny Bono, or
whatever, who knows, but whatever. If he's talking in his sleep, he shouldn't say things like that. But he did. And it just seems to me that the president moved very quickly and the reprimand, and he's offered a public apology, but I'm not certain. You just say things like that and say, well, I apologize, and then...
Should he be fired?
I don't know. I mean, that's not my judgment or anything I could comment on. Bob, I appreciate very much that kind introduction. And, of course, I think as most everyone knows, at least I hope they know, for my benefit, because we're counting on you to pull us through, that we started in the Congress together and we've served together in the House and in the Senate. And I would hope that come November 2nd, I know that Bob Stafford is going to be reelected. I think we can count on that. And I've had the opportunity to meet your governor-to-be, Dick Snelling, and also your lieutenant governor. Your new lieutenant governor, Gary Buckley. But I want to talk just a few minutes about the Ford-Dole ticket, maybe a few minutes about the other ticket, and... I don't have time to go over all the other ticket, but I'll just talk about some of the highlights. As I said early this morning in New Haven, Connecticut, where I was privileged to be introduced by Governor Reagan, I told the audience that remember one thing, that pineapple juice is better for you than peanut butter. Harper. For one thing, it doesn't stick to the roof of your mouth, but there are a lot of other reasons that Vermonters would understand. I'm very proud to be on the ticket with President Ford. Bob Stanford knows President Ford probably better than I know President Ford, but we're both going to be a man of openness and candor and honesty and integrity. And we can see in the short 2 years since he's been in the White House that the confidence in government has been restored. We're on the way to prosperity. The inflation rate has been cut in half. There are 88 million people at work in this country, the highest number ever. Over 3 million have gone back to work in the past 18 months. And above and beyond that, President Ford is a known quantity. He's dependable. He's predictable. And that's really what the election's all about between now and November 2nd. We only have 30 more days. How does the American electorate perceive President Ford? How does the American electorate perceive Governor Carter? And I have no quarrel with Governor Carter or Senator Mondale. Senator Mondale and I have worked together. We've worked on different sides. We've served together. He's an honorable man. I don't know Governor Carter that well, but I certainly never question his integrity. But I do question his judgment. I do question a man who takes positions after position after position on the same issue. And the American people are going to ask that question. It was said early on that the reason we had three debates was to accommodate Governor Carter. Now, Governor Carter has been interviewed a number of times lately. Some you've read, some you may be anticipating. He said in an Associated Press interview, and these are his words, not mine, that families above the median income, the taxes would be higher for families above the median income. The one thing he didn't know, of course, is what the median income was for an American family. And here's a man who's been running for president for 2 years, who apparently didn't know what the median income for family was. And then they rushed around saying, well, they left out words, middle income. That really changed the whole interview. It didn't change the interview one bit, because he said median income, and those above the median income would have their taxes raised. So we checked. We thought we knew about what the median income was. And it's $14,000 is a median income for an American family. That's a working husband, working wife, or anyone else in the family working. Now, I haven't found many people in that income bracket for a family who really wanted their taxes raised. And I thought Governor Carter should have known what the median income was. He said he wants to be president. You ought to judge him as a president because of what he said as a candidate. Now, that's his mistake. He also said in that interview that he didn't know if anybody wanted their taxes lowered. That's the gist of what he said. Now, I've been asking that question as I've gone around. Is there anyone in this audience who doesn't want his or her taxes lowered? If there is, we have a doctor standing by, and we'll send him out to give you immediate treatment. He also said in that interview that all incomes should be taxed alike. Well, again, I don't know what he means by that. He hasn't said. But it's interesting to read this morning that he's going back to his old tactics in the campaign, where he's not quite as specific as he has been. I didn't know he'd been specific yet. He said a lot about taxes. He said in a Liberty magazine, September-October issue, 1976, a Seventh-day Adventist publication, that I would favor the taxation of church properties other than the church building itself. While I find it incredible that Mr. Carter wants to impose taxes on church-owned hospitals, schools, senior citizens' homes, and orphanages, just to name a few, I think he ought to clarify it. What does he mean? He's talking about property tax? Talk about income tax? Oh, if it's unrelated income, it ought to be taxed. But what is he talking about precisely? The statement's very, very narrow. I would favor the taxation of church properties other than the church building itself. So I think now Governor Carter may have to explain again what he didn't mean. He never has explained what he does mean. And so I just say that the campaign is filled with contradictions. His contradictions, not ours, not President Ford's, not even Senator Mondale's. Now, I figured out that if Ford's elected, I'm going to be elected. I worked all that out. President Ford will be elected. President Ford will carry Vermont. President Ford does have a positive program for America, whether it's jobs or housing or health or education or protection against crime or recreation. This is his quality of life program that he alluded to in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he has been working. And I was asked just a few moments ago in a TV interview a very proper question, how do you assess the vetoes of President Ford? And did I think that perhaps he did some of the vetoing on political grounds? Well, as I, the last count I had, and I'll have to confess not being in Washington too much the last 30 days, was that President Ford had vetoed some 59 bills. I haven't voted to sustain every one of those. But President Ford has the larger responsibility. He has to look at the totality of everything as how it affects America, how it affects inflation. And he's made a judgment. And the easiest thing he could have done in many of those cases was to sign the bill and pass the buck to Congress. Say, well, if we're going to have inflation, more unemployment, well, Congress can take the blame because they passed the legislation. I'll sign it. That's, in effect, what Governor Carter has said because he's criticized every veto. He said, in effect, that if I were president, I would have signed everything. Now, is that leadership? No, it's not leadership. And what Governor Carter doesn't tell the American people, what he doesn't tell the people of Vermont or Maine or New Hampshire or my state of Kansas, is that for the last 22 years, the Democrats have controlled this Congress. And they've controlled the Congress 40 out of the last 44 years. And we can be thankful that men like Bob Stafford are there and are going to be there for the next 6 years to bring about that balance in the Congress, that responsibility in the Congress, and also to serve the great state of Vermont. And so I'm proud to be here for that reason, too. And finally, in any way you slice it, we're the leader of the free world. We're looked upon, we're looked up to. When someone's in trouble, when some nation's in trouble, whether it's humanitarian or whatever, they look to America. And the American people, not some government, but the American people have never failed. They've always gone the extra mile. They've always made the extra sacrifice. I guess that's the way it is.